Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
We are live with a pre-matrimonial, completely unnecessary podcast for Wednesday, October 7, 2014. Besides my still semi-single, but soon not to be, Ian Ferguson.
That's me. Yes, definitely getting married this week.
I'm Pat Contry.
On Saturday.
How you doing, Ian?
I'm
nervous.
Not really. I'm ready to go.
Cold feet?
No, I'm more just concerned, you know, about what temperature it's going to be on Saturday. They're saying 84.
That's a little toasty, but it'll be nice. It's better than rain.
Well, I have a top hat and coattails, and I mean that's going to be warm.
What is this? 1890s? You're getting married? What's going on?
Yeah.
Or are you about to do like a big symphony and conduct?
I just want to look fancy.
Look fancy. Ian, you always look fancy.
No, I don't. Right now, I look sweaty and moist.
The way the fans like it.
Yeah, exactly.
Coming up on the show, we'll be talking about the Big Lebowski pinball machine, a premiere of the new playfield, and some of the attract mode and little toys and gadgets. We'll talk about the Tetris movie that was just announced. The end of Saturday morning cartoons. Makes me sad. A new gold NWC cart on eBay without a label. The Zelda Hyrule Warriors limited edition New York City World Nintendo Edition, a Retron 5 console price increase, and your Q&A. So, your wedding's coming up. I'll be there. Frank will be there with bells on.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be a fun time.
I hope Frank actually has bells on.
You think he can get bells to be on?
Yeah. There will be cupcakes, no brownies.
Okay, that's acceptable.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That's acceptable.
There will be Mario Kart 8 and Street Fighter 4.
Whoa, on like an LCD TVs, like set up there?
Oh, yeah. We're taking two TVs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we're doing a Mario Kart 8 4-play.
Should I bring my Nintendo and my retro USB card?
No.
And
an Ultra Street Fighter 4. Not unless you want to lug along another TV.
I am good at Street Fighter 4. You've seen me.
Yes.
I've gone on a tear before.
Yes, you have.
We have also coming up the fifth annual NES Marathon benefiting the Children's Network Hospitals. Children's Miracle Network Hospitals, there it is, on November 8th and 9th, which I'm planning. Ian, he's going to be there. I got the poster coming out in a few days. The Indiegogo campaign will be live probably by the end of this weekend, if not early next week. There'll be opportunities to choose what games to select us to play. Besides, we'll have tier levels where if you hit a certain amount, we'll play a certain game or do a certain challenge like Color of Dinosaur, Sunday Fun at Karaoke, and also unlock certain things like guest appearances like in other years. So that'll be fun. We also have a Patreon for the podcast. If you want to contribute, it's up to you. It would be very appreciated to help support us. It's patreon.com/pixelsicle.
PXLSICLE.
So a Tetris movie was announced. I'm having deja vu.
I'm having deja vu too. It's like we just talked about this. And yeah, I mean, this is not something that needed to be made. And, you know, there was an article in the New Yorker, and they talked to some of the people who are going to be behind the movie. And
the Threshold Entertainment Group.
Yeah, the Threshold Entertainment Group. And they have described it as it's going to be an epic sci-fi adventure. This is not going to be a movie about blocks with feet or tetrominoes as we know them. They say that they are going to work on the general theme that Tetris is about creating order out of chaos. And so, this to me is a bunch of word vomit spewed out in the general direction of the public. It means nothing.
So they could have actually just bought the rights to use a name and then apply it to any script that they have laying around even.
Yes.
So, like, a Battleship movie came out in the past few years. They've announced a lot of these. They used to announce, like, a Pong movie and, like, Space Invaders. But the Battleship, at least Battleship, it's a goofy board game, but it's actually based on war. And there have been lots of movies, in World War II movies, about battleships fighting each other. So at least that's a tangible sort of concept.
Sure, just like when they did Clue. Yeah, yes. It was based on a board game, but it's just a murder mystery at the heart of it. But, like, that's so doable.
And you, but you use a there's characters in Clue.
Right, exactly.
There's no characters in Tetris.
No.
I don't think the Tetrads, even if they had they have names, I don't think they are, you know, their own characters and personality types.
Well, and the PR spin, the delicious PR spin on this is that they approach the characters with the utmost respect. It's like what characters? There are no characters in Tetris. There's a square. There's a Z. There's a straight piece, and there's a T.
It's a backward Z too.
Yeah. Fine.
So the handful of pieces.
Yeah.
It's funny that these supposedly, I guess, these people helped do or involve somehow with the Mortal Kombat movies in the 90s. So those were decent, especially the first one.
Yeah, but we can't really find how they were involved. What we do know that they were involved in was Food Fight, which was a movie that after 10 years of production hell, got a straight-to-DVD release. And it's about a bunch of different food brands and mascot characters trying to fend off like Nazi-type enemies from a grocery store. So it's entirely a movie based on product placement.
So it wasn't based upon the old Atari game at all?
No.
Okay, so that might have been fun.
No.
So Threshold Entertainment Group, also known as Threshold Entertainment, formerly known as Amalgamated Widgets, is an intellectual property company, which I guess that means they buy intellectual property to resell it. I don't know. Resellers? And then they have an animation subsidiary, Threshold Animation Studio, and they produce films. So the animation studio has done theme park films, Star Trek 4D, the Las Vegas Hilton, Armageddon, Les Effets Spéciaux, in Disneyland Paris, I butchered that, Mission Space, which I've been on, excellent ride, at Walt Disney's Epcot, Bob the Builder 4D at Legoland, Marvel Superheroes 4D at Madame Tussauds, probably somewhere in France, and then two, I guess it'll be the upcoming Warner Brothers Movie World, which I know nothing about, but that sounds cool, I guess. Maybe there's a Zack Snyder, you know, guy in a Zack Snyder suit running around you can punch. Justice League, Alien Invasion 3D, and a DC Comics Justice League, whatever. And they've done Lego Star Wars on Cartoon Network, Lego Atlantis, The Afterlife. And, as you said, they've done the Food Fight film. So, again, I don't know how they're going to do this, or if they're just buying the actual Tetris rights to give to someone else to do, animated. I don't know. This sounds like a terrible idea.
Could someone send them an email mentioning that 4D is not something we can see?
It's not something that Einstein's come up with a way to get to.
That's a load of bullshit. And also, Madame Tussauds is probably, I don't know, there might be one in France, but that's the Wax Museum. I think there's one in Vegas.
Really?
There's one in Canada.
So they're going to make a movie for the they're going to have, like, wax Tetris, tetrominoes, like, just pose, and then you can watch the movie later.
Yeah, I don't even want to fucking think about
it. So, I mean, the Food Fight movie that you referenced supposedly cost tens of millions of dollars somehow.
Money well spent.
Had 80 familiar mascots. That's probably where it came from. So, Mr. Clean, Chef Boyardee, Starkist, Charlie the Tuna. Who the hell would want to see this?
No one. That's why I went straight to DVD.
Took 10 years and tens of millions of dollars to produce, but failed to make it to theaters. Was released finally on DVD last year. The reviews were notably harsh. Kasanoff, who I guess is the executive at Threshold, said that it had been discouraged from talking about the project because of legal issues, but explained that Food Fight lost some of its backing during the financial crisis and had therefore never been properly completed. Oh, that's why.
Yeah.
Not the fact that it was a god-awful idea to begin with. Woo! Well, there was that documentary I was a part of 4 years ago I hosted. That's really the only thing I did with the movie. It was that, so I don't know. Tetris is a game with a storied history, lots of legal battles. Hell, that would have been an interesting idea for the movie, about maybe the development of Tetris in Russia.
Sure.
Like 84, then Nintendo and Atari fighting over it. That could have been a cool even documentary to talk about. Then how,
well, I believe the ownership rights were claimed by Russia, and, you know, Pidgetnov didn't get anything for years from Tetris.
And now I think I met the guy. He was there 4 years old documentary. So there is a company that now owns, I guess, at least the U.S. rights to it. They come out with, like, handheld games, and they do, like, mobile versions of it, Tetris. So Tetris is still around. I mean, it doesn't have nearly the same sort of chutzpah it used to.
I think EA actually has Tetris now.
Do they really?
I think.
Maybe they have the console rights to it.
Or they did. They at least did a couple.
But they don't own the rights to Tetris itself.
No.
So what are the odds this actually comes out?
I don't fucking care.
Even direct to Amazon Prime or direct to Netflix.
I don't know.
30 to 1?
Sure.
40 to 1?
Yeah, why not?
Better odds than Buster Douglas beating Tyson.
Good. Great. No one cares. But something that is much more interesting, and something that we both care about, I'm a huge pinball fan, Pat likes it too.
I love pinball.
Big Lebowski Pinball was announced last year, and I was pretty excited about the license. I would love to see an era of pinball come back where we get some unlicensed tables, but we're probably a ways away. But at least this is skewing for a different market. A lot of pinball machines that come out these days are shooting for this like mid-40s to mid-50s market because pinball machines are expensive. So you get a lot of classic rock-themed tables. You get a lot of tables based on cars and stuff like that.
Well, you get new movies, though, from Stern, though. All new movies.
Yeah, and then, well, and that's the other half of it. Then you get the new easy movies. You get, you know, the ones that are popular. You get your Iron Mans, your Spider-Mans, your superhero flicks. It's risky to take something that's a cult hit like the Big Lebowski and then make a pinball machine out of it, which is a cult hobby.
I would argue though that since that at this point, how many new pinball machines a year are there? Upwards of four at most.
Two
from Stern, one from Jersey Jack, maybe.
No, two from on a good year, two from Stern, one from Jersey Jack,
and then one from some other boutique that does a remake of Medieval
Man.
You'll
never fucking see because they do them in numbers of like 100.
Has
15?
Has that Medieval Manus remake even come out yet? Is that still in the works?
It's probably still in the works. That thing's been talked about for years.
So this is good though. I think this is at least to me. This is not a movie license in terms of like the Star Trek one that just came out with a couple years ago. Or the Spider-Man one that came out, or they do The Hobbit. I think Jersey Jack's doing The Hobbit. Because this is a movie that, like you said, it's a cult. This isn't a new movie. This isn't, like, automatically have a new fan base. This is, to me, almost like an original property. It's 16 years old at this point.
I mean, it does kind of have that feel.
This has never happened before. You do a movie that's that old.
So, anyways, I was worried because this table's being made by a bunch of, and I don't mean this as an insult, by a bunch of no-names, though, in the pinball industry. Most tables, you know, are currently designed by popular names from pinball's heyday, and the new people who are being trained up by these people at places like Stern or Jersey Jack are, you know, very much being trained up by the old guard.
Sure.
These guys literally came out of nowhere, as far as I can tell. And when they revealed the table, holy shit, it's gorgeous. I mean, there's nothing that isn't beautiful about this table. Everything from the sunken bowling alley playfield to the little Brunswick ball returns on the ramps.
Yeah, the Brunswick has a sunken playfield where you can bowl.
I just said that.
Okay.
I'm looking at it. The rug that unrolls as it gets hit. You know, all of this looks great, and it has really kind of restored my faith a little bit in the machine. Now, anyone who plays pinball regularly will tell you, you got to get your hands on it. You got to feel the angles. You got to see if the rule set is good.
Sure.
There are plenty of very well-designed machines that have horrible rule sets, and that sinks them. But at least as of right now, I am once again interested in the table.
Yeah, I think what this comes down to is this... you can buy a property like this and try to do... I don't know how you would do a cash-in on a property 16 years old, but you could have just thrown something out there. This has so much thought put into this. When you look at the things included on the playfield, you have a white Russian glass sitting there underneath. That is cool. You have the rug that unfolds, and it's almost right in the middle of the playfield. Mm-hmm. So it's tying the playfield together, like tying the room together.
Yeah, it's the center shot.
Like you said, you have the ball returns, which is like a bowling ball return. You have the upper right. That's the bowling alley in the upper right.
And the actual outside of the bowling alley. Yeah.
Yes. And so once you get up there, I guess if you put it through the garage, I think the door opens and then they actually have a model of the dude's car in there that'll be on the play field.
Yeah.
And I guess that'll probably lead to the bowling mode, probably something like that.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
So, of course, bowling, which is really what holds the whole movie together. That's really how it's structured. They're bowling in like eight scenes. That's probably what's going to happen. Well, with this, it makes sense that it's a bowling game.
Yeah, but I mean, if you look at it, it was fun because it was like looking at the lights. There's lots of like little nods to it. Like there's like Nihilist Mania or something like that was one of the light up modes. And there's a Market Zero. Yeah, there's a Market Zero. I mean, there's tons of modes that are not at all pinball bowling related. But it does look more or less like I expected it to look, which is a heavy focus on the bowling alley, which is cool. I think that's
you like that. It's just
the whole theme of the table is very bowling alley themed. I mean, there's things like the rug and the white Russian, but it is very much centered on if there was a number one design element they took from, it's bowling alley. So, and also another great thing that I want to point out, because if you don't play pinball, you don't notice this. It's very rare to see hand-drawn artwork on a pinball machine these days. X-Men machine is one that actually did it. That's a really great example of a well-designed machine that had a horrible rule set. But yeah, this is great. It's almost all hand-drawn artwork with the exception of the light-up faces for the different characters, and that could even be changed by the time the machine goes into full production.
Oh, sure. I mean, the cool thing about modern... This is the one cool thing about these modern pinball machines is that you can install like firmware and software updates that are released. So things can change. Like they said, if the rule set stinks, they could change it. That's the least of your concerns at that point with the software. But to me, they nailed this play field. They nailed it. In fact, the only thing I have a problem with is that the art is so cool. It almost looks like a machine. In terms of the color patterns, you have that reddish-orange color and the blues. It almost looks like a machine from the 70s in terms of the color scheme. And they have Bunny on one side and the old Rich Jeffrey Lebowski on the bottom. What are those called there? Those are called just bumpers?
Inlane.
The inlane?
They're the pop bumper caps. Slingshot caps.
Okay. Those are art. However, you have the faces of six of the main cast.
That's what I was saying. That's the one thing that's strikingly different.
It's just
they
digital.
Can change that.
They can change that. That's my only concern. Other than that, though, there's a bunch of different... You already see when the rug unrolls, you have the different play modes. Mm-hmm. And that art is there. So one's the rug getting peed on. One is the car getting smashed by Walter with in that scene. Was that like it was a Corvette he was smashing with the tire iron? You have the ashes scene, the infamous ashes scene. So there's a lot of cool ideas here. The thing is the price on this, and I want a pinball machine, and I only have room for one, maybe two if I get rid of some of this crap. But I have one that can go right there instead of the MAME cabinet. I would shit can that MAME cabinet in a second for a pinball machine. This is up my alley. Big Lebowski is one of my favorite movies. It's a brilliant movie. It has a twisted but intelligent sense of humor to the film. It's a film that the first time I saw in college, I couldn't stand. The second time, I loved it. I got it the second time. And a lot of people were like that. So this costs $8,500. There's no different editions, though. There's no regular, then pro, then limited. F that. This is the edition of it. The edition. And there's no going to be a limited run where, you know, we're going to make like 30 or 40 of them. They're going to make however many people buy, and they'll keep making them, which is good. That'll help probably keep the cost down in the long run. So it's $8,500 plus shipping. That's a chunk of change. So I have to think about that.
I don't know. I mean, for me, as great as it looks, I hope someone local buys one. I hope the local pinball club decides that they need to have it and they install it somewhere. Because in California... We do have one of the pinball world champs, usually the pinball world champ. I don't know if he still holds it. So we do get a lot of these nicer machines placed in bars where he maintains them for use of the pinball club. Love to play one, but 9K, not only can I not even begin to imagine what that would cost.
I
can imagine what it costs. Not only can I not even begin to think about owning something like that, but... To me, I like so many different pinball machines that I could get something that I will probably have just as much fun with for a grand. I already have one. I've got room for one more. And as much as I would love it to be Big Lebowski, I can find something just as cool for, at least to me, for $1,000 or $1,500.
Sure.
You know, if I save up for it. And that's the problem with new pinball machines. It's a rich old man's hobby, which is why I find the theme of this so interesting, because it's not really targeted to that demographic.
Well, this is how I'm going to try to justify it. For the machines that I want, and there's only a handful I'd actually would want, like Medieval Madness or Twilight Zone or the Circus Voltaire one.
Really have spent a lot of time playing Circus Voltaire.
Yeah, in Portland. I have.
Okay, that's not a lot of time.
Arabian Nights, that's a little cheaper. But these are all machines...
Topan is boring as fuck.
These are all machines that cost $4,000, at least.
Medieval, yeah, Madness half the price.
Medieval Madness will cost like six or seven.
No, Medieval Madness is about eight to... Shit, they went as high as 14.
Well, there you go. This is eight
and a half. No. The one machine you want is comparable in price. The other two you want are half the price.
Well, no, Twilight Zone's not half. Twilight Zone would probably be $4,500 or $5,000 at this point. It probably would be.
You could get four to 4.5.
And these are used. This is new too. So that you got to look at that too.
Well, we also have no idea what sort of build quality they're going to put out. I'm playing devil's advocate here because I think $9,000 for a machine is fucking insane. I think the prices Stern was charging were fucking insane.
But this is probably going to be built better than a Stern machine. I have that feeling because people complain about. I think one reason that Stern gets you to get those higher end ones because they have like the AC/DC one doesn't have the lower play field for the regular edition. It's just bullshit.
Yeah, but see, no one pays attention to those, and even the premium priced ones are cheap. They're like $7,000. And yeah, they're not the best quality. And I'm not defending Stern. I don't like a lot of their tables, but I don't know. The ever increasing price of the hobby is something that doesn't really excite me. And as much as it looks good now, I'm not trying. I know everyone's gonna be like, "Oh, Ian hates everything." Yeah. Everyone was all about Wizard of Oz, and no one fucking talks about it anymore. You know why? Because it had a great design, it looked flashy as shit, and it came out with a bare-ass rule set, and everyone was like, well, this is boring as fuck.
Well, can they update the rule set, though?
Yeah, they can, but you hate this in video games. Yeah, well, that's the problem. Okay, so X-Men finally got a good rule set. By the time X-Men finally got a good rule set,
yeah,
Damage was done. Damage was completely done. People had already sold off their LEs for, like, nothing.
This machine, though, they designed this. They actually got input on the playfield with this. A lot of this stuff, they asked way back when they announced this. They're like, what do you want to see in this game? What do you want to see?
That's not something that a good designer would ask.
Well, it looks good so far.
It does. I don't know. I hope.
I might put in. You can always cancel the pre-order. So these are going to ship supposedly quarter two of next year, probably around June.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to cancel your pre-order until you got it and realized you didn't have fun with it. That's the problem.
Well, I can put it back on eBay.
I don't know. I mean, don't get me wrong. If I had 9K to burn, I would do it and take the risk. But I'm just coming from a person who doesn't have a lot of money. That's a big gamble. Okay. No matter how good it looks.
You're talking to someone that bought two NWC cards.
I don't fucking care what you bought.
I'm just saying, I put the risk into that.
There's no risk in that. You knew that was going to go up in price. Well, you know if you ever need to get rid of those, you can.
I'm not buying a
pinball. There's no fucking risk in that.
I'm not buying
zero risk.
I'm not buying a pinball machine so that it goes up in price. I'm going to buy it to play the fuck out of it.
Yeah. What I'm saying is where was the risk in you buying the NWC cards?
That's still a chunk of change to drop.
It's a chunk of change. No risk. End of Saturday morning cartoons. Pat, take it away.
So this is depressing because this just marks the fact that Ian and I both are getting older. But it's also, I think, the change of a generational sort of attitude towards not just entertainment, but interaction. So on September 27th, the last, I guess, I didn't know it got down to this point, CW, which is syndicated, everyone is CW. It used to be Warner Brothers, and they also had UPN, and they combined to be the CW about, like, 10, 12 years ago. The last remaining Saturday morning cartoon lineup was run on September 27th, and that ended over 50 years of network Saturday morning cartoon blocks. So, I mean, it's sad, but again, I guess that's a reflection of modern times with, I guess, kids, they get up nowadays, and they'll go on their iPads or the computer and watch stuff on YouTube. Or, I mean, hell, there's no reason to even watch. This goes more and more people don't even have cable anymore. They can watch any show online or Hulu or Netflix. So what's the point of getting up, you know, to these kids? They're never going to experience, though. But it was such a social thing.
Oh, well.
Not even with just, you know, with your brothers and sisters. I had one sister. I still do, kind of. And we got up at like 6:30.
Yeah.
You got up ass early. To watch, I think, usually that early, I'd watch whatever weird-ass show was on. Probably Spartacus was still on, you know, was on Nickelodeon that early. You remember that weird-ass Spartacus cartoon? Spartacus! Anyway, look it up, people. And then from there, we're going to switch between the three, NBC, CBS, and ABC. What should we watch? Should we watch Garfield and Friends? Or should we watch this? You know, should we watch Kissy Fur? Or should we watch, you know, Gummy Bears? You know, you had to decide. You got out the newspaper, get the highlighter, and I was with this. We'd plan out what we watch. What we watch. Up and down that, like, five-hour time lock until my father would come in and yell at us at 11:30, turn the TV off and go outside. So, you know, which was usually right after Dungeons and Dragons.
This is how my brother and I used to do it this way. So we would get up about 6 as well, you know, and we would start by eating, like, you know, bowls of cereal. And whenever, you know, the show was over, you know, it would be like, we didn't want to get up. We didn't want to miss anything. So it was like, okay, if you get my bowls of cereal for the next half hour, you know, you can pick the show. So we would
bowls. How many bowls were you?
Oh, we would eat a lot. We would eat a lot. And then I remember specifically this was the thing that we did as it transitioned into luncheon time around like 11 o'clock. We would just start eating cold cuts straight up out of the Ziploc bags, you know, that my mom would get, you know, from the deli at Wegmans and stuff.
Oscar Mayer.
Yeah, no. And that's how we bartered. Like, who got to pick the next show was, well, I don't want to get up off the couch, so you go get me the food.
We would. Yeah, it's. It's sad though. Do you think kids are gonna miss something in that whole experience by, or you think it's gonna be? Are we just too? We're just looking at it with, you know, rose tinted glasses. Or is there something to be said for getting up with your siblings or friends? I mean, if you had a sleepover party when you're a kid and you get up Saturday morning and watch cartoons, or hell, every once in a while you go over to your friend's house and watch it.
I mean, I have to admit, I do think a lot of it is rose tinted glasses. It's what we did as kids.
Sure.
I really do, because they can kind of get the same experience. A lot of these kids are watching, you know, cartoons probably in the same amount, so it's not like animation's going downhill, but they're watching them later at night on Cartoon Network, like Adult Swim. But I mean,
I would say children's cartoons have gone downhill, though. That's not just me saying. Well, I think the quality per capita of those Saturday morning cartoons were, by and large, very nice. They're nicely drawn. You give me that face, but you had all the Disney cartoons. You had stuff like Dungeons and Dragons. You had Garfield and Friends, with stuff like that that was brilliant, consistently produced.
There were good ones. I mean, Voltron was a Saturday morning cartoon.
I don't count that one as a Saturday morning one. Was that on Saturday morning? I thought that was afternoon syndicated.
I feel I remember that one being on Saturday morning.
But even the Fox ones, like Eek the Cat, was brilliant.
See, Eek was, that's like one of the last Saturday morning cartoons I really remember. Now, the Tick X-Men? I loved. X-Men was fantastic. Honestly, the Saturday morning cartoons that I used to watch the most, I'm a huge Tom and Jerry fan. I used to love, like, the old blocks of Tom and Jerry.
So you're counting those? See, I'm counting the three major networks.
Fox, and those networks put those on as filler. You would get...
Very early.
Very early, or when a show would go off of that spot, okay, and they didn't have anything to fill it. I always looked forward to, like, the Tom and Jerry cartoons and stuff like that. And the Jetsons, especially. That's the stuff that I looked forward to.
And then you'd had Hanna-Barbera. Usually a USA Network would run, like, the Hanna-Barbera block.
See, I liked the USA. I actually liked the USA Network Hanna-Barbera
block. That would usually even go, I think, into the afternoons. I think Sunday morning, we'd watch Hanna-Barbera. Yeah. Would be
Maybe
Sunday
that
morning.
Was Sunday. Thing is, I look back on Hanna-Barbera cartoons now, and I find so many of them unwatchable.
Great Ape, Captain Caveman, no? You don't like? I thought there was a charm to them. What were the hounds that were solved crimes? Detected the two hound dogs? Remember that one?
Yeah, I kind of like Top Cat.
Like Top Cat?
Mainly for his little blue sidekick.
Well, the Hanna-Barbera cartoons had that other sort of weird charm to them, where it was like just a little off-kilter usually.
Some of them were all right, but like...
Captain Caveman!
You look back on Flintstones, and that's one of the most unwatchable and insulting cartoons
garbage.
I've ever seen.
That was garbage when I was a kid, and I can't watch it now.
And honestly, other than it's neat...
But that wasn't Saturday morning to me. That was Saturday morning.
No, now we're just talking cartoons.
That was a primetime show. That was a Simpsons of the 60s and 70s.
But my main reason for liking the Jetsons was its bizarre vision of the future.
Sure.
The cartoon itself, not really that great. But, it's sad. I think we are looking back fondly with nostalgia. I don't think this is necessarily a great cultural tradition that is going to be mourned in, you know, decades to come.
I don't know, but we're that weird generation that we're the last one that had it.
But I will say that when I did see that, you know, pop up on our list of things to talk about,
you got sad.
I said, there's no way. No, well, I got sad, but not because I still watch Saturday morning cartoons, but because I just thought to myself, there's no fucking way that there's no more cartoons on Saturday morning.
Well, there's cartoons, just that the major networks don't
have them. Right, but it's just, you know, my entire 32 years of existence, there have been cartoons on Saturday morning network TV to watch.
Yeah. So, yeah. And then I remember when NBC got out of it in the early 90s.
Yes.
It was probably like 92.
That's when they did.
Or 93.
Were they the ones to put on Saved by the Bell?
Yeah. They did like the block of like Saved by the Bell and California Dreamin'.
Yeah.
And they had like a third show like that. And I saw it. I was like, what are they doing?
Yeah.
NBC had like a lot of good ones.
Yeah, my brother.
NBC NBC had the Disney ones before they were even on the Disney. They had Gummy Bears on.
Yep.
And Kissy Fur and other ones like that. They had the Wuzzles. Or was that ABC? The Wuzzles. I forget. But, you know, but they had a lot of these fun sort of, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The Wuzzles. That was a fantastic concept.
No.
You weren't a Wuzzles fan?
Well, I mean, I remember the name, but I don't actually remember what the fuck a Wuzzle was.
Every animal was two things. You were a bear.
Oh!
And you were a bee.
Yeah, okay, yes. I liked, no, you were a tiger and a bee. I think it was a tiger and a bee.
But isn't that a brilliant concept? It's kind of sick when you think about it. But anyway.
I like bees.
Maya the Bee, that's Nickelodeon. That was a German cartoon.
That's been around for, I believe, 5 centuries.
We're spinning off here.
That's Maya the Bee is in old wood cuttings. Anyways, we can continue.
That and David the Gnome.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm sad to see it go. I'm sure if you go on Nickelodeon or Cartoon Network, they're still running a block that you can watch.
Sure.
It's having those networks.
Yeah.
The network blocks where every year it'd be a new set of cartoons. You'd have a few that would go on. But you'd have, like, Garfield and Friends was, like, for, like, 5 years, which is one of the best ones. But then you'd have other ones that would rotate in or rotate out.
Which one?
Garfield and Friends. Very good. Don't give me the eyes. You're gonna get killed in the comments for not liking Garfield and Friends. All right.
We're going to get killed in the fucking comments regardless.
All right, so this came up. This was a new NWC gold cart that came up for auction within the past, I believe, week, and then it was pulled. This was a strange one, though. I think this is the second one that didn't have a label on it. So if you know anything about the gold NWC carts, they're basically laser printed, the little symbol, the little triangle symbol, and then like paste it on with glue. So people were thinking that this was a faked one. However, it doesn't make much sense to fake one, and this is why. To fake one of these, you need an NWC grade cart, because you can tell pretty quickly with a board whether or not it's real or not. Faking a board probably could cost you a ton of money to come even close to doing it. So you need a grade cart. You need to cannibalize that grade cart. You need to get a Zelda cart. You need to then take the label off that and then put glue on it. But then you get to the point where you're now selling the least valuable gold cart without having a label.
Right.
So what's the point of doing that? You're running the risk of selling a gold cart and cannibalizing a gray one that won't come near probably the cost of the gray one, unless you had a destroyed gray one. So it was determined pretty quickly, and also based upon the location, that this was probably one of the unknown ones of the 26. Mine was number 13. This was the 14th one discovered, that this was probably is real, and it looks real from the pictures.
Yeah, I saw. I mean, you know, the glue itself is in the appropriate shape of the label.
Yes.
And the only thing that caught my eye, and I'm not saying I think it's fake, because I don't, but it just surprised me the way it came off in the pictures. As a person who spends a lot of time peeling labels off of things at work, you know, like old crusty labels, that looks like a pretty clean peel for a label that I kind of expected would have just been, like, shitty paper.
Well, you don't know why the kid done it and, like, scraped it off.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? I mean, that's all I'm saying. But, I mean, your thoughts were exactly mine. The price of faking this for an extra couple grand, plus all the work you would have to put into it, it doesn't make any sense to me to do it.
Well, I made the fake gold one for the video with James. It actually wasn't that hard, but getting those labels off is tough, but it took like an hour and a half, 2 hours to do it. And then you put it in the shell, and you have to cut it out. That could be a little hard to do it perfectly. But you have to fake the board, though. I mean, you don't have to fake the board. But the point is that, again, I'm tired. It wouldn't make much sense to sell a shitty one. It'd make more sense to create a fake label. That's what I'm kind of concerned about. The person that buys this, if they're going to make a shitty label on it, of course that has to be disclosed. Yes. Even though it's a shitty label to game with, you're making a reproduction label to put on it.
Well, I mean, the only thing you can hope is that
I don't picture the person. First of all, I don't picture the person buying this flipping it. I'm just saying 5-10 years from now, maybe they'll sell it. If the price is up to $50,000, they'll sell it. They should disclose that. However, the good news about these gold carts, whoever gets this, it probably will be recorded. And people are recording who buys what.
Who buys it will be recorded. So if suddenly this person is selling one with a label on it, it's an immediate red flag.
So this was found. This was found at a rummage sale, along with a lot of other NES games that were donated by someone who obviously didn't have any idea about the collection. So imagine that. I mean, hell, you got a gray one that came into the store.
Funny story. I was found at a rummage sale.
So imagine you go to the rummage sale and you see a shoebox of games. You're like, oh, Legend of Zelda. No.
Yeah.
You would, you know. I wonder if the person that found it, I'm not sure if the person that found it knew what it was beforehand, though. That's what I'm trying to figure out with that. If they went to someone, oh, look what I got, to their friend, and their friend's like, holy shit, do you know
I
what just, that
yeah,
is?
Yeah, I like all these stories of these discoveries. You know, much like the gray cart, you know, in our store, you know, a few years ago. It's always a matter of, like,
it's been like every 2 years one of these has been found.
But it's just weird. It's always like someone's in a rush or someone doesn't know what they have or, you know, this. It always seems to fall into the hands of someone who doesn't have any clue before being transferred over. It's weird how they just pop up still.
So they took the auction down. It was starting bid at $5,000. I believe they got a bunch what they believe were shield bids, but they probably weren't, some of them. And then they took it off the market, I think, to probably sell on a form like Nintendo Age. It's up in New Hampshire. That's where the seller is. That great state that I forget exists sometimes. Don't kill me, New Hampshire residents. All four of you.
Don't worry, they'll kill me. And I didn't say anything about New Hampshire.
I'll get off it. So I don't know about. It's hard to know what a price is. There has been one of these that's been auctioned off in a very, very long time. I believe the last one that sold was an auction around $18,000. This was like 5 years ago, and then I think the person had paid, and it went for the sale, and I was like
18,000 is a couple centuries ago.
Or 20,000. What's that?
18,000 is a couple centuries ago.
Are you trying to be funny, or are you being just dumb Ian? Is this dumb pre-matrimonial Ian?
Is there any difference?
No, there isn't. You nut. All right, so I'm interested to see what this sells for. I would love to see an actual auction, though, because the past few NWC cards, the past four, including mine, have not gone via auction. They've been private sale, and it's nice to see a new benchmark. You know, actually, you know what? The Howard Phillips one did go for like 17 or 18,000, but that also included a lot of his nice swag.
I'm surprised that's all it went for.
Well, that was a new benchmark, though, because before that, I think it was like 10. So that's almost double than what the one went before that, I believe.
What are the grays going for?
That's what I said.
Oh, okay. 17. Yeah, okay, yeah. But, all right,
Howard,
that makes sense.
Howard Phillips gray that he had went for like 17 and change, but he also had like all the NWC material and letters and stuff like that. So it was like, wow. So there you go, NWC gold cart. They're not a scumbag seller. They are a fortunate seller.
Yes.
Or a lucky seller of the week.
Yeah. Lucky seller of the week.
This was alerted to me by a guy named Scott, who I run into the conventions. Very nice guy. About a new limited edition Zelda Hyrule Warriors. Zelda Hyrule Warriors is a hack and slash game like Dynasty Warriors, which came out like a week ago.
I have it.
Have you played it?
Yeah, it's fun.
So this came out. And I guess a limited edition one came out only at the World of Nintendo in New York City. What was it? What was that?
300 copies.
There's 300 copies.
There's only 300 copies of the damn thing.
So people were lining up outside to get this. This also, though, came out, I believe, in Europe and Japan. But actually, the Japanese one looks a lot better. It has a freaking clock in it. This basically has a scarf. Get a nice scarf with this in a nice little collector's box. So they're already getting flipped on eBay. I've seen them go for like 600 or 700. I think one idiot bought one and I bought it now for 1,000. So I guess the question about this is, special editions are cool, but what are your thoughts about having something that's so limited and only, this isn't like a chance to get it at more than one store. You had to be in the New York City area to get one. Do you like the idea of doing this?
No, and I mean, it's hard for me to get like overly emotional about this because while I like the game, I've said it before on the podcast, I'm not the biggest Zelda fan. I like certain entries in the series, but no, I can see this being upsetting to the diehard Zelda fans, of which there are plenty, because they never got a chance to get it unless they were in New York City at the time of the release. And then you have to be one of, like, I think it was 300, you know, people who was able to get this. And if you're the hardcore collector, you're going to get it no matter what it comes with. But then you're struggling to get it, and it's not even the coolest limited edition.
No, although
the scarf is cool. I mean, I understand. But there's already people making like perfect recreations of the scarf online. Like
I saw scarves for sale that almost looked like the real ones.
Yeah, so you can get these beautiful scarves on, you know, Etsy or other places for, you know, much more reasonable prices. And I just feel bad for the Zelda completionist who now has to hunt this down. And
I spend maybe $1,000.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's kind of like... I don't get real caught up in limited pieces, but I would have taken the gold DuckTales cart, you know?
Oh, sure.
But I'm not going to pay thousands of bucks for it, you know? And because I wasn't in the gaming press, I didn't have a chance to get it.
Why wasn't I sent one?
Because you're C-list. I guess I don't
The like. U.S. version stinks. I'm going to come out and say it. The Japanese version has this cool black and white box.
Nice.
And it comes with a freaking treasure chest in it, like in the game you open up to get the items. It comes with a freaking treasure chest.
That's cool.
The U.S. versions have it. I think what happens, I think the word was, at least, don't kill me on this, but I believe that the U.S. one only came out, I guess they had leftover stuff or leftover scarves. They said, we'll just put out this limited number in the U.S.
Well, I also don't think they were expecting it to be this popular here, because it is just a Dynasty Warriors game.
Here's the fun part about this shit, though. And Nintendo's kind of done this in the past. Anything Nintendo put out limited, what's to say they're not going to do a second run of these? Because they can do that anytime. They can commission more scarves and put out 1,000 more. And then I'm not going to laugh at the people that are spending hundreds and hundreds and $1,000 on them, but it's like, you could have waited. I'm saying if it happens, there's no guarantee, but there's a chance they could do that, do the demand.
Well, and sometimes they don't hold value. We have one of the Pokemon Center Game Boy Advances in the store right now, and it's not going for any more than a normal Game Boy Advance. Why? Because it just never held its value. Also, it's a little bit dinged up, but still, you know, you would think something like a limited edition Game Boy Advance from the Pokemon Center would hold some, you know, be more, but we couldn't find a reason, you know, a reason to up the price on it.
Sure.
So, I don't know. But, yeah, I don't like the ultra... If you're going to do a limited edition, fine, but give the wide range of people who live in that country the ability to get it.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, if you're Nintendo, I mean, what did this cost at World of Nintendo? I'm guessing probably like $80 or $100. Probably,
I mean, the game was $60, probably $80 to $100, yeah.
All right, so they threw in a scarf that cost them probably $1 to make in bulk, $2. So Nintendo's probably looking like, wow, we're making a lot. This is, let's put out 1,000 more of these. That extra $4 is almost pure profit for us. You know, we can just start pumping more of these out. What if they start doing that?
Has Nintendo really done that?
What did they do with that Super Mario Brothers one that was on the Wii? What did they do with that?
Oh, no, see, now you're being a little bit misleading. The Super Mario Brothers, when they reprinted it without the history book.
Okay.
And the Metroid Prime Trilogy, they reprinted it without the steelbook case.
There was a difference?
They did make things that differentiated these titles.
Okay.
So it's not like Nintendo... Yeah, I don't think what you're speaking of is actually going to happen. It's just a matter of seeing what it's worth, and because it's Zelda, it's probably going to go up.
But it could happen.
Sure. Anything could fucking happen. I could start wings and fucking fly right now.
No, you can't. That's not going to...
No, that could happen.
No, it can't. It could. No, it actually can't.
It could. I'm a wizard. No. I'm a fucking wizard, Patrick.
So you can make a new scarf and a new box and throw it in a package.
Hold on.
Was that our new sponsor?
Ballast Point. I was hoping it would give me some wings, but it didn't. Anyway, briefly touch on the game. If you haven't played it yet, it's a lot of fun. It is Dynasty Warriors. It's nice to see the Zelda characters in HD.
Does it bother you having the character with the big tits? Does that bother you being in a Zelda game? People were upset about that.
Doesn't bother me. It's just boobs.
it's just boobs.
The addition of items is nice. It's fun that, like, when you throw a bomb, instead of throwing one bomb, you throw, like, a billion bombs, you know? It's fun. And the gamepad TV co-op is pretty fun, too.
Sure. I don't usually like third-person hack and slash like that. To me, they get old after 30 seconds. But if it's a cool concept, why not?
It's one of those things where, like, I need to play a game like that once every 4 years, and this is my fix.
Gotcha.
I noticed that's not really on here, so I'm just going to touch on it real quick. You're not playing it because you don't give a shit because you're a bad gamer. But I figured I'd briefly talk about Smash Brothers on the 3DS since it's actually out, and people are probably going to be like, why didn't you talk about Smash on the week
you
released?
You are welcome to add CU podcast topics as well. I know you don't like doing it, but you can do it as well.
Well, because we were supposed to do this quick, but you decided today was the perfect time to experiment on a new laptop.
How do you say experiment? What are you, Canadian? I guess you are. I'm from Buffalo.
Yeah, I'm from Buffalo. the new Smash Brothers is a lot of fun. It's good in local, but everyone's really enjoying it, and that's good, because I am too, but I'm going to sound kind of like a negative Nelly here. We were playing four players the first time that it came out. Okay, local four players.
In the same room?
Same room. We should not have been getting freezing.
The game was freezing on all of yours at once?
Yes.
Wow, that's some weird communication issue.
Yeah. Also, online is, I mean, and I'm hoping they'll fix it for the Wii U version, but online is, there doesn't seem to be a real in-between, at least for me. The matches are either basically unplayable, or they're smooth as silk.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
But as I play the game more, I have less and less of an issue with the circle pad. It doesn't feel mushy to me. The game feels proper. I love all the levels. The characters are fun so far.
Is there an option to adjust the sensitivity of the?
If there is, I didn't even look into it.
Okay.
Because I got used to it very quickly. So we've been having fun, and it's definitely a game that Vonnie and I will be taking with us when we leave, because it's just so perfect for like plane flights and train rides and stuff like that. I'm interested in what the competitive scene is going to think of it, though, and if they've laid down their...
I don't think it'll be competitive, because you won't be able to put on a big TV.
Well, it'll be competitive at places... You're kidding. Yeah, you're crazy. At places like conventions and stuff,
I mean, it's not going to be any of these huge tournaments for cash.
Well, no, but it took Smash Brothers forever to get into a huge tournament for cash.
But yes, you can put that on a TV, though. This you can't put on a TV. There's no output.
Which
is insane that they didn't put an output on 3DS.
I know. But. I'm saying, I realize the Wii U one will be the one used for tournament. I'm just saying, competitively, the people who are trying to play competitively online right now
Are they trying to already?
Well, yeah, people are playing. I mean, I'm sure they are. I mean, that people
are there love- rankings? Is the For Fun and Glory mode also in this version? As well as the...
Yeah, and okay. Honestly, I like it. And here's something fucked up. You ready for this? I like playing without items.
Oh, God, we lost you too.
Nope, you didn't lose me. You didn't lose me, because I'm still doing 50-50, and I love playing with items as well. But, like, what I've been doing is I'll play, like, 3 or 4 games with items on, and then I'll turn items off for 2 games. And it is fun to see how much it drastically changes the game. You have to understand that this is the first Smash I've put any real time into. I mean, even Brawl I didn't put a lot of time into since the N64 version. So to see how much the game has kind of progressed and balanced with the limited moveset, I don't know that I prefer it without items, but it's definitely actually fun without items. It's not unplayable. It's neat, especially because I think the levels are designed better so that items aren't necessarily necessary. Also, whenever I play with items, I always throw the item directly in a hole.
Because you have no hand-eye coordination.
Exactly.
That's not the game's fault.
Right. So if I so if I turn items off, I don't have to embarrass myself by constantly throwing items into pits, holes, and offside.
So no fun factor, but at least I don't embarrass myself.
Fuck off. Anyways, so lastly here on our main topics,
woo!
Hyperkin. You guys can fucking blow me. Retron 5 price increased by $20.
Where was this reported, or is this something in the trades? Like,
we got an email saying that the MSRP for Retron 5s would now be $159.99.
Talk to the Mikey.
The MSRP for Retron 5s would now be $159.99.
So, if you've been keeping track, about
two. It started at $100.
It started at 100.
Then 140.
Then they raised the 140, I believe, in the spring after all the delays. And then it finally came out in, like, what was it, May? So now with the controversy with the source code, and especially with SNES 9X and the Genesis emulator that were included, that explicitly say you cannot use this in a commercial product, besides perhaps the other alleged misuse of all the other open source GL.
But plenty of people have explained how they can, but they have to make it available.
They haven't done their job.
They didn't do what they were supposed to do to make it okay.
Basically, the best way to make this okay is if you ship the damn thing with no software and told you where to put it on yourself. Then that would have been maybe okay. You know, or release all the source code way up front and not waited.
Or put it all on their website. Here's the problem. If what I'm getting is kind of... They had to make it available. So if on the Hyperkin Retron 5 website, sure, they had put all these emulators, this is what we're using, then I believe, and someone can correct me, and that's fine, because I'm probably wrong on all sorts of aspects, but they need to make this available, and they need to acknowledge it. So they could put it all on the Retron 5 website is what I'm thinking. Sure. And then they could release the Retron 5. Here's the problem. If they put it all on there and everyone realizes it's just a fucking emulation box, then everyone's going to go make their own goddamn emulation box.
Yes.
So I think they were being really sneaky about it.
They're being sneaky, and then plus, yeah, and the fact that they're jailhousing it and not allowing you to do anything with this software they don't own. They're basically changing how the software is to be used to their own device, which, again, there's a lot of shit. Here's the thing. Why did they raise the price by $20 more?
Well,
why?
Who in their marketing? I mean, I'm under the impression this is like 5 people. Who decided that was the way to suddenly generate goodwill amongst people after the scandal came out? Like, yeah, we did. We used other people's emulators and we didn't credit them. And by the way, we're going to raise the price $20.
Do you think this is either one, a reaction? I don't think it'd be out of spite. That'd be really weak of a company to do that. Maybe they see, hey, we're going to need money for upcoming maybe a legal battle. Or maybe they're thinking, let's not produce any more of these because there might be an injunction. So let's just pump the consumer for as much cash as popular. Say they have 1,000 left that they're going to come out with, and that's it. That's... So to them, we're going to be making $20 extra pure profit on 1,000. You do the math. That's a lot of money. It's $200,000.
Those are the two theories that I've heard the most. And honestly, those are the two that have entered my head. And after thinking about it, I think it...
That's $20,000. My math's wrong.
My math is always wrong. So. I think it's... It could potentially be that we've got a warehouse full of these. Let's make the money off of it. We can. And then we may have to go back to, you know, the drawing board.
Oh, okay. So the same sort of thing where, yeah, we have a, say we have 1,000 left. After that, we're going to start from scratch.
Because if I remember correctly, and I could be totally wrong, but I don't think I am, I believe the Retron 5 was not supposed to be emulation-based initially.
Really?
Yeah.
The cost would have been exorbitant then to have all these different readers and, you know what I mean, have all the actual hardware on it.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Nintendo on the chips are cheap.
But then you have to do that for 7 systems.
Well,
and
yeah.
And then you're getting to that point where then you wouldn't have all that 100% accuracy emulation.
You don't have that.
No, but I mean, if the emulators can do it properly.
Okay, right, I get what you're saying.
On the chip, always have issues with sound, and it's always...
But the people who I mention it to, and I can't rule it out, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, they obviously raised that $20 because if there's going to be any sort of legal action, they need the extra money. And that's possible, too. I can't imagine that Hyperkin, knowing what they sell stuff for and knowing what our profit is on it, I mean, I don't think that they're a company that's necessarily swimming in fucking money. So if something like this were to come along, if a suit were to come along, they could sink them very quickly.
Sure. I saw something about that they came out with a new update, actually, the firmware a couple days ago, and I think they locked it down more than what people were doing. People actually figured out how to add the IPS patching to ROMs, which, if you know what IPS patching is, it basically enables you to add, say, translation to a Japanese ROM for, like, Fire Pro Wrestling, mm-hmm. things of that nature. And so people were doing these with their games, or you were adding, say you have a Pokemon ROM and IPS patch, I guess you can unlock, you know, the stuff without playing through it, things like that. So people were figuring out how to do that on the Retron 5, and I guess the latest patch takes that away.
people won't grab the latest patch. I mean...
So it just goes to show they're trying to control this device when it's only a matter of time where this thing's going to be busted wide open.
They should have thought about this way more than they did.
There you have it. So if you want to get the system, go out and get it. It's just the moves they've done from a PR perspective, though, over this whole long, drawn-out process have not been good for them.
No, I think it's kind of gross.
We are going to Q&A time on the CU podcast. First up is at Leaving Luck. Do either of you own any Game & Watch units? Any thoughts on the Game & Watch collector's market? I own about 6 or 7 Game & Watches. Most of the basic ones. You're not talking about rare ones. Maybe a couple that are hard to find. I have Tropical Fish. But I also have, like, Donkey Kong 1, Donkey Kong 2, Donkey Kong Jr. I have the Legend of Zelda ones. I have the Mario Cement Factory. I have the Micro versus Ice Hockey one, Donkey Kong 1. So these aren't ones that are terribly hard to find, even though it's not like you're going to walk down the street and find a Game & Watch. Because they're probably the most coveted handhelds out there, because it's Nintendo, and they're very well made and very fun. In terms of the collector's market, I know that it's very particular in terms of condition, things like that. And I know that, basically, yeah, you're at the whim of eBay prices for the most part, because it's not like you can find this on the street, or mostly most stores don't have them.
No. People have asked us before if we carry them, and we don't. And the reason why is they're decades old at this point, and the lamps can burn out, you know, basically the spots on the LCD, and that will destroy the value of a Game & Watch. I myself have owned a number of Game & Watches. I have owned some of the rarest pieces, but they never seem to stay in my hands for long because, well, fuck, weddings, trips, funerals, things like that. It's the easiest thing for me to get rid of. The one that I had the Mickey Mouse Panorama, Snoopy Panorama, which are two of the hardest to find pieces. My Mickey Mouse I got when it was relevant, but two of the lamps ended up burning out on it.
But you got the Snoopy one.
Mm-hmm. And I still have the Zelda double screen one. My late grandmother gave it to me, and I'll never get rid of it. It doesn't hurt that the Zelda one is actually a ton of fun to play as well.
So, next question is from at WB Stillwell, and he asks, "Hey Pat, I saw on your Patreon page that you have a stretch goal of a TV show with Frank. Could you talk a little about that? So basically, on my Patreon page, yes, I started a Patreon.
Oh my God.
For my series.
I called you making that joke, and you were like, I wouldn't make that joke, and now you're making that joke.
I didn't make it in my video for my Patreon page somehow.
I'm very happy.
But anyway, yeah, Patreon, we have one for the podcast. I'll start one for my individual videos, because it is a separate entity. So basically, the biggest goal is, I would like to, I would love to do sort of a It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia style tone of a series. I think that's what my writing is sort of geared towards. And I think if I took the character of Pat the NES Punk in that universe, that's what I think would naturally would come about it, something like that. Because when you see me do some of my skits in my videos, whether they were with Ian or with Frank, they are a little kind of goofy and cornball-y. And sometimes I go into a little weird areas. So just imagine that, but actually having a cast and getting into situations, talking with girls and getting into relationship troubles and going to the bars and having Frank get into a fight, maybe a bar fight or something here and there. I think there's a lot of stuff that could be mined from that. And people have asked in the past, would you do a Pat the NES Punk movie? And my answer usually default is no, I don't think you could work it as a movie. But say if you did a 22-minute episodes, you could do something. The risk is a lot lower there, and creatively, the risk is a lot lower because you can do one 20-minute episode and then have, you know, that's one story, but then you have an overarching plot where something else is going on. I think that would work better with my style. I'm not saying it's ever going to happen. It'd be nice to get to that goal, but I'd love to see that be a possibility. So, next Ian's question is, this is, speaking of Ian, this is from wow, that's a really hard one. At NSA19984987. Where did you two guys know each other from? And Pat, where do you know Frank from? Where I know Frank from will be revealed, potentially, in a future video. But how did I meet Ian?
Frank is from the boiler room.
You want to talk about how I met you? You remember that sunny day in July of 2008?
I was sitting behind the counter and some other jackass came in, and it was Pat. And he kept coming in every summer. And
it wasn't every summer. It was the next summer.
It was the next summer. We became friends. We had those endless summers, surfboards, makeout sessions, cold beers on the sand.
California dreaming.
California dreaming.
I like the show.
I believe the first thing he ever bought from me was a boxed Prince, a complete Prince of Persia for $7.99.
Not true.
What was the first thing he ever bought for me?
It was Baby Boomer.
Oh, Baby Boomer. That's right. Yep, for $15, I believe.
I came into the store. This was at the location on Voltaire Street, which I love that location.
I miss that. Look, I mean, I don't miss it in the summer. It's a fucking sweatbox.
So kitschy and just, I love that store. If you see my Couch on 6-1 review for that store.
Yeah, the oldest videos with him in it have the old store.
So, yeah, I came in. That was, I think, the Saturday or Friday I came in. I came here in 2008 to go to Comic-Con because the Watchmen panel was there. That was the last time I ever got into Hall H on a Saturday morning for the Watchmen panel. Damn you, Zack Snyder. Anyway, so yeah, going to the store, Ian seemed a little, you know, a little strange, a little sort of one of those employees that, yeah, he's the type of guy, like a record store employee that, okay, what do you want? You think you know more than me about anything? And I talked to him, and, you know, I talked about collecting, how, you know, I had a good chunk of games, looked around, I picked up Baby Boomer. I believe I picked up maybe a couple others at that point. I'm not sure. I think I got the Prince of Persia the next year.
That was second year.
I think I bought maybe 3 or 4 games. Okay. But at least Baby Boomer.
Yeah, Baby Boomer was the good pick.
Baby Boomer. And so maybe Pest Terminator. Or no, it was Baby Boomer.
No, you definitely got Baby Boomer from me. Yeah.
I was thinking I maybe got Pest Terminator 2 males the next year. And that was the same weekend where I went to the swap meet for the first time in San Diego and got the Virtual Boy in the rental case, you know. And I was like, wow, I'm probably going to move here because of that. Frank, Frank mailed that back to me, actually. I'm like, hey, Frank, mail this back to me. He's like, all right. Yeah. So the next question is from Karen. Hey, Karen, at Niemla. How do you explain your video game collection to, quote, normal people who don't do gaming or collecting? All right. This is, I think the best way, this is how I did it in New Jersey, at least. When if you go on a date with a girl, you're lucky enough to bring a girl back home to your apartment, and the first thing you see is two big shelves of games, you say to them, okay, I have this hobby. I'm passionate about old video games. I grew up with them. I think they are great. They are fun. And I think as long as you don't talk about it in a creepy way, you try to bridge that sort of gap about, this is what I enjoy doing. They're fun. It's like collecting music or movies.
Sure.
They'll understand it. And I'd say 90% of the people I've talked about with it got it and liked it. And most of them are even like, oh, you know, let's play, oh, I like Duck Hunt, or let's play a game or something. And, you know.
It's funny. I think people look at collections and they initially,
Does it have the stigma it used to?
No, it doesn't. And that's the thing. First of all, I don't think collecting games or music or movies has the stigma that it used to. Two, I do think that the first time a friend comes over or someone that you're dating, but, you know, like, even just, like, you made a new friend and they come over and they see something, they're going to attach something to you. Like, you know, they might look at video games and assume you're a huge nerd, or they might look at records and assume you're a you're very pretentious, or they might look at, you know, movies and assume something similar. But, you know, once they know you and they look at it, provided, and another thing is organization. It's like, any collection looks good well organized.
Yeah, mine was organized.
And then what you have to do is, you have to kind of, if they look at it and they say nothing, you just leave it at that. But if they express interest in it, you invite them to look at it.
Sure.
So, like you said, you invite them to look at the games, because everyone knows NES games, and they might find something they want to play. If it's a movie, you know, your friend might see something they haven't seen in a few years and they want to watch it. What happens all the time when people come over to my house, because I listen to music all the time, is, you know, they initially see this daunting record collection, but then they kind of start idly flipping through it, and they go, oh, Smokey Robinson, and they pull it out and they're like, can you put this on? So, you know, I don't think collecting anything has the stigma that it used to, but it's just a matter of keeping it organized and inviting people to partake in it with you.
There was one girl I went on two or three dates with, and the first time she saw it, she was okay with it. I guess either she probably soured on me or wasn't into me. So by the last time I saw her, she literally made like a 40-year-old virgin comment. And I didn't say anything, but I was like, well, that's kind of weird, because the first time you saw it, and second time, you didn't say anything. So it's like, that's kind of weak, you know, to say something like that. But like I said, most people that are, you know, they have no problem with it, you know. And now it's out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah.
From anyone. It's tucked away in the game room.
All right, I'm going to read this one, because I like this question a lot. Travis McMillan. Travis, we love you, but stop posting so many questions. You get one. Your questions are good, but you get one. Okay? Quality, not quantity. Loaded question. How much does video game history suffer from revisionism? I.e., E.T., worst game ever, Super Mario Brothers 2, illegitimate, etc. How much? A fuck ton of it. Okay? Pat and I have mentioned this in passing before, but, I mean, just to go with the ones that you mentioned right now, E.T. is not the worst game ever. E.T. has a lot of problems. E.T. is not even a particularly good game, but it has a lot of good ideas. Super Mario Brothers 2, at the time, no one gave a fuck.
They didn't know, or they didn't care. Actually, no, Nintendo Power actually mentioned it. That was Doki Doki Panic, and no one gave a shit.
Right. No, but here's the thing. At that point in time, no one was used to sequels to these games.
Yeah.
They weren't blockbusters, so no one was necessarily expecting more of the same. It was just something different. The one that I always bring up, because I know it's hard, but it so totally gets unfairly shit on, and it's one of my favorite games, is Zelda 2. Zelda 2 is a fantastic game and is dumped on constantly by modern gamers.
But it wasn't when it came out.
But it wasn't when it came out.
It was excellent.
Yeah, and it's only dumped on because it doesn't fit the mold of other Zelda games. So a lot of this, a lot of, I think, modern opinion on older games, like the ones you had mentioned, is definitely...
I think this comes from younger people. So they think that, they grew up with the 64 Zelda games and on, so that's their idea of a Zelda game. They go back to Zelda 2, this isn't what I'm used to. Or the same with the Super Mario Brothers game. Super Mario Brothers 2, the quote-unquote real version, is a piece of garbage.
I like it. But
I don't
like
it. Because all they did was add like a few new elements to it, pasted the rest on, and made it really fucking hard. And that was just Super Mario Brothers 2.
I mean, I like that, but I don't necessarily like it more than what we got as Super Mario Brothers.
Oh, it's not even close. We'll add wind to it. We'll add a dumb mushroom, which makes no sense. Howard Phillips explained this to me in person, because I asked him about it. I was like, all right, Howard, what was the deal with this? Why did Super Mario Brothers 2... Why didn't the Japanese come out? He said, they sent us the game to North America. We played it, and I was like, all right, first of all, it's really hard. But second of all, you just change all the gameplay balance from the first one, which made it a good experience, right? You can run through quickly and get the mushrooms. You can't run Super Mario. You cannot run through the Super Mario Bros. 2 Japanese version quickly at all. You get destroyed. So they basically changed what made the first one good. And he said, because
someone putting a speed run into the comment section right now.
Exactly. Yeah. But do that. You know, the first 100 times you even play it, and it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
You know. So they basically it changed the foundation of the gameplay of the first one, and I agree. Why put in power ups that harm you? It doesn't make any sense. You know, is there any games that really have done that to that extent? Especially after the first one, we're used to that. You know, and so no, I'm glad we got the Doki Doki Panic version. I think it's a wonderful game. Again, I think there's an echo chamber with commenting on the internet, and you seek out people with similar comments. So if it gets to the point where, you know, oh, it's the worst game ever. Zelda 2 is, you know, it's not a real Zelda game. So you find where the people have the same opinion, and then it just grows from there.
Right.
So then when new people research Zelda 2, they'll come up with, why Zelda 2? Someone blogs, why Zelda 2 is not a real Zelda game? Why E.T. is the worst game ever? You know, and that's where it comes from.
Yeah.
Because when these games came out, when I played 2600 games at my friend Billy's house, we must have popped E.T. in, and we never said, "Oh, this is the worst game ever." Compared to the other 2600 games, it's on the same. It's almost on the same sort of platform as the other 2600 games. It's not. You know what I mean? There's a lot of bad 2600 games out there.
Oh yeah,
you know?
Tons that are worse than that. I had a guy in the store the other day who just incessantly argued with me that E.T. and he kept saying this. E.T. was officially the worst video game ever made.
Oh, was it voted on?
Yeah, and after he said that, like, for the fifth time, I'm like, it's really not that bad. I said, I've played it, it's not great. I said, but it's got some good ideas. And he kept saying, like, it's officially the worst game. And I said, how is it officially the worst game? He's like, I read it on the internet. Oh, and wow. At that point, I was just done.
Well, that's a bad thing with, using the internet for general knowledge at all. I think I spoke about this with, it could have been Frank a couple weeks ago, that our generation, at least mine, are the last to do research without using the internet.
Sure.
Actually get out books, look up magazine articles, maybe use a computer to look up journal entries, but actually go to the stacks, look up journals, look up magazines, and get that and use that for source of information.
But
not
you
just
can
the internet.
Use a computer to do old school research without having to go into the stacks. But
I'm talking. People use the internet as a consolidated Wikipedia page of knowledge, and that's my knowledge, versus going and getting those individual sources and reading through themselves and making their own decision. So there's something to be said for that. I'm not saying for video games you can always do that, but it's the mindset of, here's the easy summation of the Legend of Zelda 2, Adventure of Link, and what people think about it, versus thinking for themselves and doing their own research, or even playing through the game themselves. Yeah. And our last question for this CU podcast.
Oh, dear John Jablonski, I like you. Dear someone, who would you cast as lead in Danny Sullivan's Indie Heat the movie directed by Zack Snyder? My go-to pick is going to be Jean-Claude Van Damme, so we can get that epic spot where he is doing the splits between two Indie cars.
So you're talking, this is like 1980s Danny Sullivan.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm thinking more of a modern,
so an older fellow.
An older
gentleman.
More distinguished Danny Sullivan. More of a mentor role.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a Morgan Freeman.
Oh, okay. That's
We're
fine.
Some gravitas there.
Yes.
He takes on a youngster on the indie routes there on the races. And then, you know, maybe suffers a tragic injury halfway through. Or actually, no. The young guy suffers a tragic injury. Then Morgan Freeman comes and he has to do the final race. So a reversal.
That's fine.
Because the greatness of Danny Sullivan... You know, you cannot throw that under a rug. You know, you have to.
That's why I wasn't throwing the greatness of Danny Sullivan under a rug. That's why I said Jean-Claude Van Damme. I'm just envisioning the movie of being more of an action racer.
Okay.
Where you're seeing something a little bit more dramatic.
More docudrama.
Docudrama, right.
Like Oliver Stone's Nixon.
Yes.
You know, so you go along, you hit the points of historical accuracy, but also you embellish a little bit.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
So.
All right.
Yeah.
Oh, no, that's not our last question. We got one last one from Jeron.
Which I put under the things because we're not close to Halloween. We're having another podcast.
Jeron, sorry, we're going to have to wait until Halloween.
We're not close to Halloween about a Halloween candy question.
Sorry about that tease, Jeron. Okay, that's the end of the podcast. Pat, take us out of here.
So, next time you'll be listening to us, probably be 3 weeks, not 2 weeks, because Ian's going to be, I think, in Buffalo then. Or no, he'll be on his honeymoon then.
Buffalo and Toronto.
Honeymoon in Toronto. Very nice. So, mm-hmm. I might do a Patcast made by myself in 2 weeks.
Yeah, everyone's going to love that. That'll be well, actually, some people might love
Some people
that.
Will love it. I'll put DDP in your place there and may have better comments than you, better opinions that people want to listen to. So we'll see you in 3 weeks for sure. Ian will be married. I'll still be Pat. I'll still be plugging along. I'll have a new Flea Market Madness out within a couple weeks. I will be doing a Halloween video. before Halloween this time, and I said every year, but last year I think it was November 1st, so that was the closest I've ever gotten for a Halloween video.
I'll believe it when I see it.
So we're going to take you out. Thanks for listening to us on iTunes, which we are highly ranked a lot. We get usually up to number 4 or 5 or 3 last time, so please listen to us on iTunes. We're also on Stitcher.
But hey, because people always say every week in the comments, why are you only on iTunes?
We're not.
We're not.
We're also Stitcher. On Stitcher or thepunkeffect.com.
Exactly.
Or you can listen to us on the YouTubes when our video ports come out. So for Ian Ferguson, I am Pat Contry. Take care and happy wedding, Ian.
Oh, thanks.
Sound enthusiastic.